Hello and welcome to the Weekside Podcast. I'm Jenny Brentis. I am sitting here in the studio with Connor Orr. It is championship week in the NFL. We both are fresh off attending games in the divisional round. We are headed out to more conference games this upcoming weekend. And last week's games, Connor, that was a wild weekend of football. I was in Baltimore. I watched the Titans' stunning upset of the number one seeded Ravens. You were in Kansas City, which was an even wilder game than I witnessed. And hopefully it sets the stage for another exciting weekend of the championship games.
Knowing that you were in Baltimore, so I was watching the game on TV in a bar in Kansas City. And I was getting super haughty because it was actually the bartender said it was after the Titans went up like 7-0. And he loudly says to everyone at the bar, and this is clearly an anti-Lamar Jackson person, like the person who says like running quarterbacks can't be successful in the NFL, like this kind of guy. And then all of a sudden he says, well, the Ravens have never been punched in the mouth all season. And watch, the Titans are the team that punches them in the mouth. And then I'm, you know, sitting there going, okay, the Ravens are going to come back down and score and everything's going to go back to normal. The next, they go up again, and then he says, not only that, Lamar Jackson should not be considered for the Most Valuable Player of the Year award if he wilts under the pressure in this game. And I'm sitting there like, okay, they're going to come back, and this guy's going to shut up. And it never happened. Oh, yeah. My God. I can't imagine what it was like seeing it live.
It really was a stunning game, because I felt out of all of the weekend games, this one was the biggest
stunning
lock. Yeah,
stunning.
Like it was, you know, it wasn't the wildest game. That was certainly the Chiefs rallying back from the 24-0 deficit. But going into the weekend, I would have said out of all of them, the Ravens are the biggest lock, and here I am underestimating the Titans. But there were a lot of bad Lamar Jackson takes during the game, people saying that it proved right the scouting process, it proved that this offense doesn't have sustainability, which is why I wrote after the game, like, it's one game. It's, yes, he lost last year in the playoffs and this year in the playoffs, but he's in his second year. He's been to the playoffs both times. He still had several exciting plays. He fought all the way till the end of the game. And, you know, there were a lot of factors that went into the loss. And one of his teammates after the game, Miles Boykin, said, Lamar is the weight of the world on his shoulders. It's about time that we do a little bit more to help him. You know, maybe if he's throwing a little bit off today, maybe we make the harder catch, you know, or maybe we don't rely on him. And he said, because we'd been doing this all season, we just relied on him making every play, and we get into a game where maybe we should have made more plays for him, which I think speaks to also just kind of the feeling about him in that locker room, and the fact that Orlando Brown went up to him after the final drive and, you know, basically said, this one game doesn't define you. You know, they're part of this young core that they want to build something together. And I thought it was pretty profound that another second-year player went up to him and said, hey, it's just one game. Like, we're in this together. We have a bright future ahead of us. And you know how it is in the NFL. You might never get back to the position that you were in. But I feel like using this one game as a referendum on Lamar is pretty unfair and totally inaccurate.
And, I mean, their offensive statistics were really good. I mean, they put up a lot of yards. I think they had a good number of first downs. I mean, I don't know. What was the feel? I can only imagine, you know, that is a fan base that got super accustomed to the whole season just stomping all over everybody. What was the energy like there?
Yeah, it got pretty quiet in the stadium pretty quickly because, and to your point, Connor, the Ravens were moving the ball well. They just weren't finishing drives. Mm-hmm. And so they just weren't, you know, getting points. And so it kind of quickly got away from them. And once they went down 14-0, they got away from the run. And I think that was the fatal flaw in the game. But yeah, it was kind of, there was so much energy in the city the morning of the game, down in the Inner Harbor, all these Lamar Jackson jerseys everywhere, so much excitement. And they talked all week about avenging last season's wild card round loss. And so I think, yeah, it was a stadium that like didn't exactly know how to act. I did laugh though before the game because there was a woman that had a poster and she said she, you know, she'd been a fan since I forget what year it was, but she had, you know, a team photo and she's ready and she goes, we've been waiting so long for this. And I was like, well, I mean, other fan bases might beg to differ a little bit. I mean, you have two Super Bowls. You were in the playoffs last year. So I was kind of like, have you though? But hey, I appreciate the enthusiasm. You know, someone really feeling like, you know, they got to make this night into a special night. But
can I throw out this is going to be a bad take, and feel free to just kind of stomp all over this, but I think I have now been to almost every road game at almost every team. You know, I've seen almost every fan base, right, in action.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say that most fans suck. They suck at this. If your team is down 2 touchdowns, you give up and you leave, or you're quiet. Like everybody. That was the same in Kansas City is the most vaunted, feared fan group in the country, and I will say when they were winning, it was spectacular. The stadium was rocking, but it's always easy to do that when you're winning, and I am stunned, especially in all these playoff atmospheres, during these big losses, everybody just sits on their hands when they start losing.
So that's what it was in Kansas City.
It was, yeah.
It was totally dead.
It was so quiet, and I remember this specifically is, you know, up in the press box, we're kind of soundproofed a little bit, right?
Right.
When they have the glass.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to kind of take what you, you know, take what you can hear with a grain of salt. But I remember when the Texans got up 24-0, it was so quiet that you could hear the public address announcer give every minute detail of the 50-50 ticket drawing. And like, there was no chatter. There was no, you know, no buzz. And I was like, but this is Arrowhead. You guys are the Chiefs fans. And this is not knocking anybody. And maybe it's different now, or you can make some sort of, you know, whatever, the kids these days don't care as much or whatever. But like, we've been doing this for 10 years, 11 years, 12 years. And I don't know, I would say most fan bases just kind of suck. They sit on their hands when they start to get down by 2 touchdowns.
I agree. They give up pretty quickly.
There's no, you know, let's get back into it. Let's, you know, I don't know. And I'll get 100 tweets after this being like, I was cheering. But
no, but NFL, it's different. You know, coming to the NFL after having covered college football was really stunning to me, because Beaver Stadium at Penn State is what, 106,000 or whatever it is now. And so going to cover a game at Giants Stadium was just like womp womp. Like, I was like, where's the crowd? Like, where's the marching band? Where's the excitement? And like, it wasn't until I covered a game the Jets played in Pittsburgh and I was like, okay, so here's an example of a really into it fan base. And then Arrowhead, you know, and the Packers, I think those are among the best.
Seattle.
Yeah, Seattle. Yes, Seattle. Great one. Don't want to leave them out.
Yeah.
We'll be on.
We'll definitely hear about that.
We'll definitely hear about that. But yeah, it's more fair weather fandom in the NFL than in the college ranks. Because in college, you go to the school, you're inextricably tied to it. It's just a different allegiance, I think.
This is not, this is a random aside, but I think if you're an owner, you give tickets away to people who care, because it's so obvious when it's like a bunch of business people going to the game together from the accounting firm, and they don't want to act like a giant idiot in front of their boss, and so they just sit there holding their beer and they don't yell. But that's why you're there. That's why they built the stadium. That's why they call it home field advantage, because you're supposed to be helping, you know, and you're not. You're not helping.
This intro took an interesting turn, but I kind of like it, Connor.
Okay.
I like where we headed with this.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I would say my only other takeaway from Kansas City was just, you know, I decided to go to the Texans locker room after the game just to see what it was like.
Yeah, and you wrote a great story, really captured.
Oh, thank you.
A collapse.
It was just like, I mean, it was quiet. Everybody would expect it to be quiet. I will say that the Texans players handled that extraordinarily well. Like, everybody talked. Everybody was very open and honest about what happened and why it happened. But, you know, it was the game was just so weird. Like, to be up 21-0, it was so, you could feel it when Bill O'Brien decided not to. There was confusion when they're up 21-0. He didn't know whether he wanted to challenge the spot on that fourth down. And then when they decided not to challenge it, he didn't have a play call to get in on time. So they had to take the timeout, kick the field goal. I think you could feel a little shift there. And then the fake punt was it. I mean, that was the catalyst. And it's interesting because everybody is throwing that on Bill when it's more of a, you know, a couple players on the punt team. So that is a site adjustment thing, you know, where they get a certain look and there's a call that comes in and says, okay, we run it. And, you know, this, they practiced it all week exactly like that. But yeah, after that, I mean, it was an inevitability, and it was a 24-point lead, which is so crazy to me, you know? But it felt like so inevitable that that was going to happen.
Yeah.
They just broke open.
We will get more Texans talk later, Connor.
Yes.
We will talk about the teams that are still alive, and we will also talk about a team that hasn't been to the playoffs in, you know, since
2002.
Yes. So Connor remembers all of that in a second. So let's start with the first news topic here.
All right. The San Francisco 49ers will host the Green Bay Packers on Sunday to determine the NFC champion. One Mike Shanahan disciple against another. One mercurial star quarterback and one potentially mercurial star quarterback to come. One generationally great defense and one middle of the road defense. Who do you think will represent the Super Bowl from the NFC?
I'm on the Niners train, Connor. I mean, this is a humble moment for the podcast.
Oh, we got called out on
this. We got called out for mid-season prediction that the Packers would expose the 49ers as paper lions.
Oh,
I believe that's what it was.
It was flattering at least to know that people are listening.
That's true. That is true. You know, all feedback is good feedback.
Yes.
And that was one of those moments. So I'm on the Niners train now, though. I didn't pick the Packers to get out of the first round out of the divisional round. So I thought their performance, you know, it was better than expected in some ways. They did barely hang on at the end. So I think it's an intriguing matchup. And it's interesting that, what did Kyle Shanahan say this week? That it would be stupid to overlook the 49ers given the result of the earlier matchup in the season. But I like Kyle Shanahan's experience, maybe,
yep,
like going into this matchup. Like, I feel like his play calling is, I don't know. I think it really makes it hard on the opponent. And as well as he and LaFleur know each other, I feel like Shanahan mm-hmm. will be a step ahead in that matchup.
I agree. I think I needed something like, well, you're more of a person of science than me, but like I needed something like to stick into my brain to make me like the 49ers that was like just sort of a fact of some kind. That,
okay.
And I think, you know, I was working on something else this week and that someone was saying that the totally different amount of ways that they do the same thing make them almost impossible to mm-hmm. game plan for. And I think that, you know, even if LaFleur comes from that school, it is much more difficult for him to have a canon of things to prepare for, like you said, than Kyle. And I just think that while the Packers might spend all week driving themselves nuts, the 49ers can kind of allow the game to come to them, and it would take sort of a more stunning performance from Green Bay than the other way around.
I think that is always the one of the most challenging things to match up against. And you would always hear that about the Patriots, too, when we covered the Jets back
yeah.
in, you know, 2010, 2011. You would always hear it was hard to defend the Patriots because they would do the same things out of different looks and different things out of the same look, right? And so I feel like, obviously, very different offensive scheme, but it's the same idea
yeah.
that, like, you have so many – you can get to the same thing so many different ways.
Yeah. Now that my Seahawks are out, you know, they were my preseason Super Bowl pick.
That's right,
you know,
Connor. Yeah.
I just don't have a dog in this fight, you
okay.
know? I'm just, you know, to me, if you had made the AFC championship game, the Super Bowl, I would be fine with that, you know? I don't need to see any of these teams. They're fine. They're both great, you know? They're both doing a good job. That's all, you know, that's it. I'm excited, though. This will be the first time I have not gotten to see the Packers in person yet this year. So that will be an enjoyable experience. I'm going to San Francisco. I'm going to go stay in one of these nebulous vampire tech campus cities, you know, down near Santa Clara.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so that'll be fun. but I don't know. I just think it's going to be a lot on LaFleur. And I think that either way they can be happy about this season, regardless of how old Aaron Rodgers is getting, and there's obviously going to be a pressure at some point to capitalize on that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think it was fine. You know, it's a good season.
It was fine.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it, though. It'll be fun.
Yeah, it'll be an interesting matchup, I think. All right, topic number two. The Tennessee Titans head into Arrowhead as extraordinary underdogs, especially after watching the Chiefs shred the Texans 51-31. Though there might not be a more hard-to-predict team in the NFL right now. Is this a walk in the park for Patrick Mahomes, or are we in for something truly stunning, even more so than the divisional round the week before? Well, the Titans really are capturing, you know, they're, it's, all of those teams that you just have that feeling about is the Titans this year, mm-hmm. right? Like the Eagles or the Giants yeah. or Giants of 2007, to be clear, not this year's Giants, just that, yeah. you know, just in case that was nebulous. But yeah, they just get, you know, things come together. They're not the flashiest team, but they get it done. You know, Derrick Henry is just such a, like, I think it's really demoralizing when you know you have to stop him and you still can't do it.
Yeah.
I think that's demoralizing for opponents. And, you know, I don't know. I still think the odds are against the Titans here, but it also wouldn't shock me if they won.
They do some of the things that Baltimore does well, in that if they get up early, they can control the ball for the rest of the game fairly well. But I think it's just so interesting the way that they've taken, you know, nobody talked about their offensive coordinator, you know, when they promoted him, and all Arthur Smith has done is find something that perfectly fits all these pieces together. And it's like Ryan Tannehill and Derrick Henry and, you know, all these things that nobody could make work before. And I don't even think Matt LaFleur made work as well as he has, you know?
No, definitely not.
And to me, that was stunning because, you know, there's always that, you know, that pressure to say, okay, well, we have to do what is successful in the NFL right now. But I think what we're seeing from the Titans is very unique. It's sort of a little bit of a throwback with some fun sprinkled in.
When they started rebuilding this team, I went to one of their early drafts. It was the year they picked Conklin. Mm-hmm. And I talked to John Robinson, and he talked about kind of like, you know, being the zag to the zig. Is that the right phrase?
Yeah.
You know, everyone was going lighter with these pass defenses, and they were going to build this, you know, powerful run-oriented defense that would overwhelm those, powerful run-oriented offense that would overwhelm these smaller defenses. And it really has come to light, that vision. I mean, at that point, Vrabel wasn't the head coach, and I think he's certainly added, you know, I feel like he's kind of the, having been a linebacker in the 2000s, I feel like he's kind of the perfect person to lead a team
sure.
that's built in that image. But I was thinking back to that conversation now, and boy, that really has come to fruition.
It is interesting that we saw a couple of teams try, like, see that inefficiency, mm-hmm. Baltimore certainly being, you know, the other one there, mm-hmm. and to do that. And you wonder where that's going to go from here now,
right.
because it's such a copycat league. Is it all going to cycle back to power football, or the smart teams going to remain kind of the way they are and get even faster and smaller and see if they can expose, you know, it'll be very interesting to see what the move is after this year, given the success of Baltimore and Tennessee.
And to your point, if the Titans get up early, basically what they do is they drain the clock, they limit your possessions, limit your opportunities, which is so key against the Chiefs. I mean, you have to slow down the game. You have to limit the number of possessions, because if you don't, you'll see them running out of fireworks, which was another great tidbit from Connor Orr's Twitter feed during last week's game.
I was shocked, though, and one of the things that I don't think the Chiefs will have the benefit of as much this week is, I mean, Patrick Mahomes had a ton of rushing yards last week, and, you know, I don't know if the Texans were just kind of losing the spy. I mean, there was certainly a linebacker attached to him that you could see was kind of scrambling out of place when he got out of the pocket, but especially early on when they were down as much as they were, those were the plays that set up the touchdowns. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, there were these big, you know, whatever, 20, 30 yard runs that, you know, really flipped the, you know, I hate to use the word momentum, really got the previously distant emotionally crowd back into it, and but set them up in the red zone. And I don't think that's a luxury he's going to have against this defense. And I think that if they play the way that they did, similarly sloppy, even half as sloppy against the Texans, they're going to lose by two touchdowns. I don't think they're going to have the luxury to get back into a game like this.
Yeah, yeah. I think it'll definitely be a different dynamic. I'm really excited for this matchup.
I think you have, like, between the two, everybody is saying that, you know, I was telling somebody, it's like, oh, yeah, I drew the, which game are you going to? And I told them the Packers and the 49ers. Like, oh, that's by far the best one. I disagree.
It's because the Titans, people just kind of forget about them. Small market team. Like, they don't seem to have a lot of buzz. But it's kind of like new school, old school football, kind of clash of the,
yeah,
clash of different philosophies. I don't know, Connor.
Boy, if you're Vrabel, why don't you take a page out of Bill's book and play the nobody thought we were going to be anything card? They haven't even ventured down that path yet, you know, I feel like. Do you think, have they or no?
No, you're right. Yeah.
They been wandering down the media didn't care about us path
yet? I haven't heard that. They've done the, you know, they've been willing to go at it after, like, you know, there was a report from the Boston Globe that after the Patriots win, they were laughing like hyenas or kind of mocking the Brady video. And then last week they were saying big trust on their way back into the locker room after beating the Ravens. But both of those occurring after, right? So, but I haven't heard a lot of the media. I don't know.
That could be something, you know, if you need
Connor,
to whip them up a little bit.
Just really waiting to pull out the card.
Just give me a call, Vrabel. We'll work this out.
If you're the NFL for the NFL 100 year, do you want the Titans in the Super Bowl?
No, you want Mahomes and Rodgers,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the...
Yeah. So we know what the NFL is rooting for, so...
Shadowy forces aligning right now. Be careful, Vrabel. You need to be prepared for anything.
Don't challenge pass interference.
Don't challenge any pass interference. Get to bring a backup headset. You know, have Mariota ready to go. Like, just be ready.
Just have your head on a swivel, as one of our former former colleagues at the Star Ledger used to say, okay? Have your head on a swivel, Mike Vrabel.
Very, very true. All right, so... This is number three. The Browns have hired Kevin Stefanski to be their next head coach, theoretically uniting the team's analytics department and their coaching staff. Cleveland has hired and fired a lot of coaches over the years, and there's really no reason for me to expect that this is going to go any differently, but I don't know. Give me a reason to believe.
Yeah, I don't have one, Connor. There's a lot of talk about, okay, they're aligned, and I think what that's supposed to mean is that Stefanski is willing to kind of fold into the owner's vision for what the team wants to be. But, you know, I don't know that that's not necessarily, I don't know that that is necessarily a great thing. At their press conferences today, they disputed the report over the weekend that Stefanski would have to turn his game plans in on Friday to the analytics department. But there was a second report that he would still have these long debriefing meetings on Monday with the owner, and Haslam said that was true. Now, I think that is extremely problematic.
Wow.
He had some kind of line saying, who doesn't want to do a debriefing session on Monday? I'll tell you who doesn't want to do a debriefing session. Probably every head coach in the NFL.
Yeah.
You have a lot of tape to get through on Monday. Who has time to sit with the owner, and what are you talking about? And why does it need to be a... First of all, no one likes long meetings anyway.
No.
But especially on Mondays.
They never accomplish anything.
You know, it's, yes, there are owners, you know, you criticize, okay, so-and-so is an absentee owner. But, you know, I do, okay, so maybe what's the right balance between not being absentee and not being overbearing? But, like, this is firmly in the
overbearing
camp. This
is overcorrecting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
I had to write, like, a, you know, who won and who lost, winners and losers of the coaching cycle. And I did a really painful deep dive into how I covered every Browns head coaching hire since I started not just covering one team, but covering the entire NFL. So this is back in 2014. So that would have been the Pettine hire and Hugh Jackson. I think that was it. And then Freddie Kitchens, but mm-hmm. I wrote about all three of them.
We went through this on the, actually Gary and I had an embarrassing couple seconds on the pod where we were trying to remember the order of the Browns head coaches, but you got it right, Connor. Pettine, Hugh, Freddie.
And every single one of them, there's pitched this new idea and this new energy, and my God, I bit every single one of them hook, line, and sinker, the worst being the Hugh Jackson one. And mm-hmm. I remember writing so convincingly, I was like, Sashi is a lawyer. He's an arbitrator, and it's going to be perfect. You're going to put personnel, coaching, and the arbitrator on the same playing field, and arbitrators arbitrate for a living. So they're naturally going to come to a conclusion that's good for everybody. And I'm thinking, because this is how it was, you know, I made some calls initially to some other team presidents around the league who knew Sashi and who had worked with them. And this is how Sashi told them that he thought it was going to go. And I'm like, oh, this totally makes sense. They're going to change the way that the NFL works. Not so much. Freddie Kitchens. He's one of the guys, and this is a team where you need to be one of the guys, and this is perfect after all this nonsense with the lawyers. You want to get back to football, guys. Not so much. now it's going to be, oh, everyone's all, it's the analytics team, and everyone agrees with them and believes that. I'm not doing this again. I'm tired emotionally, and I'm not going to buy into this one.
The problem is we haven't pitched that there has been alignment with all of the last few hires.
Every single one.
Right? Yeah. That has been the common buzzword. So hearing now, oh no, now they really are aligned, is very difficult to believe. Now, in fairness to you, Connor, Hugh Jackson did last longer as head coach than any of those on the list you mentioned.
Yeah, that's true.
He lasted 2.5 seasons. And I think part of it was the fact when I did a story on him, gosh, I think it was partway into his second season, he was talking to Haslam all the time, just like Stefanski has promised to do. He was texting with Haslam's father. Haslam's father would send him encouraging texts. So I've sort of heard this before where you're like, this head coach is, yes, I will have the conversations with the owner. And Hugh definitely did that, which again, I think is probably another reason he did last so long.
What's interesting to me, though, and I agree with you, the big nugget takeaway here is that they're going to have some form of, if there is a game plan meeting, right, the biggest disconnect, if you talk to anyone around the league, is that it's the football people coming to analytics and analytics people coming to football, right? And it's finding that way to translate all the information and to make each side understand what is important to the other side. And I don't know, if you're turning in a game plan, what are you turning in? Like, are you saying that, like, this is how we're going to, like, every game plan is so different situationally based on everything, you know? How can you explain to them that, hey, this is what we're going to do, you know?
Right. And in fairness, they said that part was not true, yeah. But it came from somewhere, obviously, in this idea that, and the way Stefanski responded to it was like, I like information, I want information. And so that's fine. Like, I don't think it's the fact that the analytics department will have a prominent role in the organization.
No.
I think it's the role of ownership, really, is the most troubling to me. And that ownership has devised this as the best setup for the head coach, where they're talking all the time and he's kind of under the thumbs of all of these different, right? I mean, that's, I think, the issue, is that he's under the thumb of the owner and potentially under the thumb of the analytics department, where if you're the head coach, you hire the person to sort of lead and make the decisions for the football side.
If you're going to do what the Browns are trying to do, I think, like, you know, if you're trying to emulate that setup, what's interesting is a lot of Major League Baseball teams have the setup that the analytics department essentially controls operations, right? But what do? They hire recently retired former players to coach the team because they're the intermediary. They're the people who can say, no, this stuff really works, you know, and they're more there as a manager and not as, you know, sort of an independent schematic operator, you know? Mm-hmm. Whereas I think if you're hiring someone like Stefanski, it's like you're saying to this person, we want to bring you in so you can be creative and you can do the things that you like to do, but in these confines, which I think might be difficult for somebody to take that. You know?
And I misspoke a little bit. I mean, obviously teams, there's a general manager or it could be an EVP of football operations, but I think the most coveted head coach candidates are the ones who do have a vision for the entire football operations side, right? And of course the general manager has responsibilities, but for instance, Josh McDaniels came in with, this is my plan, and they weren't willing to accept a plan that came from outside of the organization, which I think is also troubling, because it's whatever you think of Josh McDaniels, he's coming from this wildly successful organization and has a sense of how it could work. So you're saying, no, this is our plan and this is what we're sticking to, and we're not open to ideas from outside of the building, even despite the fact that we haven't had success here.
You know, I was just trying to you're right. Monday is such a scramble for coaches. And if you were to have a big, like, I hate meetings discussing my personal failures, which this would be if you lost, B.
But this is what our lunches on Tuesdays are, Connor. Before we record this show on Tuesday, Connor and I have a lunch in which we do kind of discuss our personal failings.
Just can't believe that. You know.
Really had a bad week this week. You know, I failed on multiple fronts, Connor. Do you agree with me?
It would just be like, you know, I come home from Kansas City and, you know, you take the 5:45 flight out on Monday morning, and then be Monday afternoon, I'm in the office with Gary or Bet or Adam or one of our editors, and they sit there and they're like, well, Connor, let's go. All right, paragraph one, wouldn't have started here, you know, bad lead, missing comma. You know, that failed to set the scene for me, you know, could have gone with better rhythm. I'd want to smash my head off a table. And they were right about everything. They would have been right about everything. But I don't want to hear it on Monday morning, you know?
Yeah.
That's the thing.
I think it's a little problematic.
It's tough. I don't know. That's going to be tough. Speaking of problematic, what do we have for number four, too?
Texans head coach Bill O'Brien told reporters this week that he hopes to keep his general managerless situation intact for 2020, despite losing a playoff game via complete meltdown. Should he be allowed to make that call? If you're Cal McNair, are you looking elsewhere with Saleh and Bieniemy available? Interesting question, because a lot of the top candidates on the market this
still
year
there.
Are still there. So mm-hmm. You could make a late decision.
Yeah.
Now, it doesn't appear that they'll go in their direction, but you have to look at, you know, earlier in the show, we talked about the Ravens and people putting a lot of pressure on Lamar for two seasons ending with, you know, a loss in their first playoff game. And I'm saying that's unfair to put it on a quarterback, which I absolutely think is true, especially he's shown a lot of promise and, you know, he got so much better from year one to year two. So you expect there'll be another jump from two to three. Opposite of the situation with O'Brien.
Yeah.
He's 2-4 in playoff games, has had a lot of playoff meltdowns, and has been there long enough so that we know what this is. It's not like a young quarterback who's on a steady trajectory up. Like, this is what it is. Now, Deshaun Watson has expressed his confidence in O'Brien, which is an important vote, but the way that playoff went and the fact that coaching decisions became such a big part of the second guessing and how that game unfolded, I think you have a lot to think about if you're Cal McNair.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to the timing and everything, and maybe you're worried that a new head coach wouldn't be able to compile a staff in time. You know, I would argue that if you went the direction of hiring the 49ers defensive coordinator, there's three or four capable people you could probably take with you right there, you know, and start, you know, bringing people from your own staff that, you know, would be in line for a promotion anyway. So, but I think it's gutting. I mean, I think that is on par with the Falcons Super Bowl loss, you know, in terms of the visibility and the optics of it, and I think the difficulty of getting over it. And especially, I mean, what was the criticism of the Falcons? I guess that they took their foot off the pedal a little bit too soon, but the Texans, it was a lot of different things. I mean, mm-hmm. you don't kind of finish them off there on that fourth and one. You don't have a play call ready to send in during that situation. Mm-hmm. The fake punt call, while it was a sight adjustment, is something that you could easily call off. And, you know, I'm not going to individually pick all these things because, of course, you know, if the fake punt, I didn't hate it as much as everyone else, because I think if it actually paid off, that was the gut punch, right? And that was the thing that was going to knock the Chiefs out. But, you know, you gave up touchdowns on seven straight drives, mm-hmm. regardless of what, you know, regardless of the decisions that preceded that, that's inexcusable. And that's, I think, an NFL record. And it's just, it's something I've never seen before. 51 points in 30 game minutes. I mean, that's ridiculous. That's unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah. I thought the bigger gaffe was not having a play that you liked or not having a play ready and
yeah.
then calling the timeout and then, you know, a little bit of chaos there. You know, I agree with you on the fake punt. I mean, I think it's good insight that basically players are looking for a look. But you generally in those situations, you would say going into it, we'll look for that look on this play or we won't, right? Like it's, you don't necessarily have that on
right.
every punt.
Exactly.
Now, maybe they did, but, and I brought this up on the show on Sunday night, Connor, but if he thought he needed to win 50 or if he thought he needed to score 50 points to win, why are you kicking a field goal
yep.
instead of going for the touchdown? If you think you have if you're only essentially, what, you have 21 points, so you're less than halfway there of what you think you need, then you probably should be going for the touchdown there.
You probably should be going for the touchdown. You know, as much as accomplished as Romeo Crennel is, you can't then go throw the wagon behind him and say that he's a lock to be back and that everybody just needs to put faith in this as it is presently constructed.
Right. You know? That's the other thing. You're asking a lot for people to put faith. After a stunning collapse like that, you're asking for a lot to put faith in as currently constructed. I think that's really well said, Connor.
Yeah. I don't know. Weird. But I will say this, you know, as embattled as O'Brien was, I think that I've never seen a locker room, and I wasn't in the Falcons locker room after that Super Bowl. I've been a fair number of losing Super Bowl locker rooms and losing general locker rooms because we did cover the Giants through some of the lean years there. That was a team. Character-wise, it's very like stand up. Like everyone was a very stand up person there. I was very impressed, and so I think if you have that, at least, I mean, that's something, right? That's more than a lot of other teams can say. They handled the loss well, despite the stunning nature of it, and you're not at least starting from nowhere. You're starting with something. So I guess there's something to be said there. But
yeah, all right. Topic number five, Connor. What do we have?
Joe Burrow and the LSU. Tigers won the national championship on Monday, and most prognosticators, including on the broadcast, they were talking about it just like it was an inevitability that he's going to walk straight into the number one pick in the 2020 NFL draft with him. I'm not 100% sure it's going to happen. Do we think that this is a situation where we saw the 2020 number one pick play against the 2021 number one pick in Trevor Lawrence? And is this were we looking at the future of football last night? We're recording this on Tuesday after the Monday game.
That was a pretty good matchup for the future of football.
Yeah.
Well, Trevor Lawrence, last year at the owners' meetings, Albert Breer and I did a poll of which players you thought could go directly to the NFL after their freshman year. And Trevor Lawrence's name came up, which is rare for a quarterback because you often hear, you know, they've got to develop a little bit more and it takes a while, yada, yada, yada. But there were evaluators that said Trevor Lawrence could definitely go from freshman year to the NFL. So that speaks to how NFL evaluators were already viewing Lawrence.
Yeah, yeah.
But this was not about Lawrence. It was just he was a throwaway, I guess. Or not a throwaway, like an add into the topic. It was mainly about Burrow.
Well, I think both of them. I mean, you know, right. And I think it's interesting. I mean, you know, for me, you know, if you're talking about the future of football, another aside is I think that the most interesting person for me in that game was Joe Brady, the LSU offensive coordinator. Mm-hmm. You know, we had heard that he might have accompanied Don Martindale into an NFL job. That was reported at some point when he'd entered the ring and started doing interviews that he was going to take Joe Brady with him. Maybe Matt Rhule is a connection there that maybe he moves to the NFL. His transformation of that offense was stunning. And I think what's going to be interesting from an NFL level is if you're the Cincinnati Bengals, you got to peel the two of them apart now, right? You got to peel apart Joe Burrow and you got to peel apart the offense. You know, what was him? What was the scheme? What was LSU running something that people just had never seen before? And how do you reconcile that? I think these next few months are going to be fascinating because I don't know if it's an inevitable guarantee that he just walks into the number one spot.
Right. Because every year it seems like in January, we talk about this is the definite number one pick.
Yep.
And then it rarely works out that way that the person you think is going to be number one ends up going number one.
Yep.
So we didn't think that about Kyler Murray at this juncture. We didn't think that about Baker Mayfield at this juncture. So just thinking about the last two drafts, right, a lot can change. But certainly there is that a lot of that buzz right now around Burrow. So
when was the I promise this is not a if it was a long time ago, I promise this is not a mean question. I just haven't closely followed college football. And full disclosure, I think I went to a school who last won a national title in the 1950s. But when was the last Penn State football championship? When was it? Do you know?
1986.
Mm-hmm. So you don't have like a memory of that.
No, I mean, in 1994, Penn State was undefeated, and but it was that they should have been the national champions that year. So I have a memory of that team.
Okay.
So, you know, they gave it to Nebraska instead, and it was really Penn State got robbed. If you ask most people.
I guess I just, you know, I was watching the end and I was, you know, before I fell asleep, and I was, you know, they showing all the fans and I thought it was really nice. I think for the fans of Louisiana, they seem to really get behind that team. But I'm trying to think about it. I don't think I've ever rooted for a team that in my sentient lifetime has won a championship of any kind.
And, really?
Yeah. So the last...
Or... The perpetual underdog.
Yeah.
Wow.
Because I grew up, my family is huge Notre Dame. That's their big thing.
Okay.
I was born in 1988, so they won the national championship when I was 6 months old. Mm-hmm. And then that was it. They haven't won one since. The Orioles? No. The Browns? I used to like the Browns when I was a kid. Definitely not.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I don't know.
Well,
yeah.
I heard they're aligned now, though, Connor. So could be the year.
But it wouldn't even be like special anymore. You know, I'd just be like, well, you know, it's work. You know?
Right. Right.
I guess I would wonder when that would, you know, what that would feel like.
Oh,
you
I know? See. I yeah. see. Okay. Yeah. Well, I do remember the 94 season. And I had, when Facebook came around about 10 years later, when I was in college in 2004, I joined a Facebook group. It was a very long name, but it was something along the lines of like, join this group if you believe that the Penn State Nittany Lions got robbed in the 1994 season. And it was full of people who were like me, had like grown up. But yeah, I mean, 1986, I was 2, so I don't really remember that. And so, yeah, I guess I've also missed out.
I wonder if I would be a good fan. I would hope so, you know? Like, I would be, like, the fun kind, you know? Not the destructive, immediately greedy, and, you know, high expectation fan, you know? I would hope that I would have been a good fan.
I think most people want to be good fans, but Twitter has turned most people into bad fans, is how I feel.
There are just, this is, like, we're going to get to the fun stuff in a minute, but there are just these weird asides of pockets of fandom that are so fun. Like, Twitter has made so much fun. You know, and they all have their inside jokes, and if you catch on, it's really enjoyable to follow. Like, a certain segment of Seahawks fans are very, very funny, and mm-hmm. I do like, they have the weird Brian Schottenheimer pictures that they put up at odd times, and I get a chuckle out of that, genuinely. And so I do think they've improved the conversation there, but there are some where it's just like, whoa, boy, you're just, I would hate to see what the rest of life is for you, because this is not... The way you treat the fun stuff is not good. You
Connor,
know?
I'm confident you would never become that kind of fan.
I think so. Probably not. Who knows? I don't know. Are you ready, Jenny? Because we've got the fun pipeline coming. We've got the Oracle. We got the Ventus Consensus and our to-be-named
new Bachelor segment.
I'm going to give myself a half a point again. So this is 2 in a row.
Wow. Actually, I gave you 3/4 of a point.
You gave me 3/4 of a point for Joe
correctly.
Judge. Yeah.
Okay. So let's, you know.
During the Oracle, I make a prediction. It's a bold sort of sweeping prediction. 2 weeks ago, I said that a surprise candidate was going to be named head coach, someone who wasn't on a 25-person list that I wrote a couple weeks earlier, and Joe Judge gets the job. So Jenny very graciously gave me 3/4 of a point. I don't know. I thought that was very generous. And then last week, my prediction was that the Browns were going to hire one of the 2 hot playoff coordinators and not Josh McDaniels. So I feel good about that one.
Great.
That was a good one. So I'm going to slide into this one feeling good and almost 100% positive this is going to happen.
Oh, boy.
This is a little bit of a slow burn prediction.
Okay.
But based on the success and the feedback loop that CBS has gotten from their surprise Hall of Fame inductions, this is going to become a thing that we are never going to be rid of. It's going to be like, what's like a viral thing that always had like a almost like a wedding proposal or a
gender reveal.
Yes, it's exactly what it is. Yeah. Hall of Fame announcements of the new gender reveal.
Wow, that's good. That's good. Yes, I think you nailed it.
I take nothing away from Bill Cowher and Jimmy Johnson. That was a very nice moment to see Troy Aikman crying. In the booth and all of this very tastefully mm-hmm. done. I would not want to find out that I made the Hall of Fame with my coworkers. Like, if I made the Sports Writing Hall of Fame, you know.
Wow. I feel personally attacked.
I feel bullied. You are a friend.
We'll get to that later. Nice. Just setting up the Bachelor reference here.
You are a friend first and a coworker
second. Oh, thanks, Connor. Okay, I feel a little bit better. My heart feels warm again.
Like, you would want to be around the people that were responsible for and who sacrificed the most for you to be able to get to where you are, right? I mean, you know, you would, if you're a football coach, you would certainly want to, the first thing you would do is thank the rest of your family for, you know, you weren't there for 20 years. And that's how I got here, was because I got to work 15 hours a day, and thank you. And, you know, I don't know. They seem to love it. But I would wonder if you're taking away a little bit of the specialness of it for them. Maybe they just want to find out with their wife or their husband or their kids or something like that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I see the point there. I mean, it's interesting because it's the centennial class, and so things were done a little bit differently. But like, I also felt like by doing it on TV, you sort of lend a little bit of credibility to the idea that someone's TV career had played a role leapfrogging other candidates, right? I mean, Tom Flores' name came up as someone who's been left out of the Hall of Fame. You mentioned that right before we recorded. Also, you know, Dick Vermeil. Like, there's a lot of other candidates that are, you know, really deserving and would like to get in. And, you know, I don't think, I mean, clearly both candidates are deserving, but when you do it on TV, do you make people think about, well, is their TV, post-TV career in football playing a role as well?
Certainly gets you a 10-year, $100 million contract with the Raiders, too. If that helps.
Nice, Connor. Nice.
The optics of it, too, I mean, David Baker does a wonder. He's the Hall of Fame man that you see everywhere, right? He is the 6'10". He's like 6'9", isn't he? He's very
6'9", I think.
He's the proprietor of the Hall of Fame. He's the guy on the sideline. When you break a record, he handles the ball with white gloves and gets to the chopper and they fly it to Canton, whatever. It's like he surprised, you know, these guys. He was like creeping around the corner and like surprising Bill Cowher. I would have been like, whoa, what are you doing over there?
Right.
You
know, right.
It's not what's a good show where they used to surprise people in a nice way? You know, like a home makeover show or something, you know, where they're ta-da,
yeah,
you know.
I feel like a lot of these surprises, I actually knew somebody who was on What Not to Wear. Was that the TLC show where they surprise him? And I don't think it was a very pleasant experience for her because you sort of like feel like totally attacked. Like, oh my God, you think that my wardrobe is horrible. And like, you think that I've been walking around like a schmuck for the last few years. And like, oh my God, how bad must it be for you to want me on this show? I mean, obviously this is sort of like the other end of that. Like, you know, obviously you're getting a big honor, but I think a lot of people don't like surprises is my conclusion here.
I do not like surprises. Mm-hmm. I'm not a person who handles surprises well. I don't know. I just think if you're the NFL, you got the social pop. Everybody's talking about it. If you're going to do it again, just think about it. Consider all angles. Ask some people who are in the running and just think about it. That's all.
Got it. You know? Got it.
I don't know. That's my take on it. But I know that that could be divisive. And luckily, now we have the Ventus consensus, which is going to bring everybody together.
Well, Connor, for the consensus, I'm going to build off your reference not so long ago about earning a 10-year contract. All right. So we have the news that the Raiders have fired their defensive line coach, Brenson Buckner, who by all accounts did a pretty good job this year, right? The sack total last year was the famous 13. This year it was 32, which wasn't the most in the league, certainly, but was a big improvement. Did a good job with rookie Max Crosby. The run defense was improved. So the consensus here is that when you make this kind of postseason panic move, it's more of a reflection on the head coach than the job that the position coach was doing.
I totally agree. And this is like, it's weird. It's like, it's very, it's a very high number. It seemed like almost abnormally high. Like, it started a few weeks ago when the Bears got rid of their offensive line coach, their offensive coordinator, like a handful of guys from their staff. The Broncos just fired their offensive coordinator who won like five games with an assortment of random quarterbacks. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's just the Jaguars just parted ways with their offensive coordinator. And, you know, while some of these things you could be like, okay, you know, it makes sense. And maybe you've discovered then that somebody is now going to come available. There seem to be these en masse changes that people are making to sort of, while you don't say it, quietly says, well, this is actually the problem. It's not what I'm doing.
It's not what I'm doing. Right. Yeah. And it's not so, I mean, this one I think was a surprising one just because by all appearances, like things were going pretty well. And hey, you know, Buckner was a big star on Hard Knocks, really got a lot of pop in that show. So maybe too much pop.
Too much pop. Whew.
Lots of things are possible. I don't know. But yeah, I think that's a thing that we can all agree on, Connor.
Knock on wood if you hear me. And I'm knocking on wood right now. Yeah.
All right. Now time for our last segment.
So this is slowly becoming the highlight of my week.
It's just our Bachelor segment. You know, I don't want to impinge on other segments that have similar names. We're just going to give it a nebulous Bachelor segment.
The weak side Bachelor segment.
The weak side Bachelor. Yeah, so I did a little bit more research and I was concerned that there was a copyright infringement. So we're just going to rename this week's segment. But listen, this was an all-time episode.
Great.
It was going on during the national championship game, so it allowed you time to toggle back and forth. But even if you watched it all the way through, you still had plenty of time to watch the rest of the national championship game.
Yeah, exactly.
College football. Actually, that could have been our Rentis consensus that college football games are too long.
4 hours.
Too long.
My
that
God.
That was brutal. But on The Bachelor, we had the champagne. I texted you last night and I said, I was a little bit behind and I said, I just got to the champagne theft. And I said, excuse me, I meant the champagne theft in quotes because who knows what really happened here, which was then followed by, okay, so Kelsey has this bottle of champagne she brings from Des Moines, Iowa to share with Pilot Pete. She says she's been saving this for a year. Now here, okay, I have several questions here. How are you flying with a bottle of champagne? Why is this one bottle of champagne like all that special? Like,
they don't make champagne in Iowa.
Yeah, like, couldn't you just buy another bottle of champagne in LA? But she's imported this bottle of champagne. They do make some wine in Iowa. It may surprise you to learn.
Interesting.
Yeah, but I don't think it's good wine.
Corn wine?
And she has this whole setup, and then Hannah Ann walks past, and she makes a line about how she's wearing a champagne dress, and there's champagne out for them, and they should just drink it. I mean, okay, a couple thoughts here, Connor. Clearly it was set up by the producers.
Yeah,
clearly
no doubt.
The producer said, hey, there's going to be some champagne when you're out in the corner. Why don't you sit down and pop it?
They are sneaky, the evilest people on earth.
Yeah.
Aren't they?
Definitely. And then they could claim ignorance by setting up that second sham champagne set up and being like, we actually meant that there was another champagne set up. We had no idea about Kelsey's setup, even though it was by far the more prominent setup in front of the fireplace with the blanket.
Wow. So is your we got into this a little bit before we started recording. Do you think that Hannah, who was accused of stealing the champagne and stealing the moment, do you think that was on purpose? Do you think she actually did it on purpose?
I don't think so. I think she just followed the little cue from the producers.
See, I think Hannah is not in the best possible way a total assassin. I texted you this last night in all caps. Hannah A is an assassin. And I think she's got this entire game figured out. I think she's the Kyle Shanahan of the class this year.
Wow.
She's 10 steps ahead. She knows when to dial up the big shot, which she did during the runway fashion show. I think she's a mile ahead, which is not good normally, right? You don't want to be ahead this far in the race early. Right, because a lot of times the show makes us want to think that you're in a certain place, and then you end up kind of flying off the radar a little bit.
Absolutely.
But so far, very, very impressed with everything I'm seeing there.
Hannah Ann should not have won the runway show.
Totally disagree.
How could you disagree? Her outfits were basic.
It was the wedding dress was the kill shot. That was that. That's what you dial up. We talk about no risk it, no biscuit. I mean, that was putting it all on the line. You're completely putting yourself out there. You're saying that, you know, I am showing you a preview of the future at a time when everybody else is thinking, oh, you know, is it what color should I be wearing? No, you get the wedding dress out and you say, I know. I'm already beating all of the rest of you to the front of the line. This is what you're going to look at on wedding day. Bam.
Well, Victoria came out. This is what you're going to look at on wedding night.
that's a solid point. Yeah. but her, you know, I don't know. I think that she's an interesting character to me. I don't have her figured out yet. And I just have a weird feeling that she's not going to prominently play into the long term of this show. Mm-hmm. Whereas Hannah A, I feel like, is going to be at least in it until the very end.
I definitely agree that of the major characters in this episode, being Victoria, Hannah Ann, and Kelsey, that Hannah Ann will last the longest.
Kelsey is the Luke P of this season, right? She's just going to cause some problems.
Producers will suggest she stays around.
She's going to throw a few elbows, and you're going to say, why is this person here? Strangely deep into the season, you know?
One thing that I was wondering last night, when there were differing accounts of the exchange between Hannah Ann, the confrontation when Kelsey was mad that Hannah Ann popped her champagne. I mean, first of all, okay, like, the pop of the champagne, I've never heard a champagne bottle pop that loudly. that clearly was added in,
yes,
right?
Okay. Yes.
The second question I have is, do they let the contestants go to the footage?
We need reviewable pass interference.
Thank you, Connor. Right? So if she's saying, like, if she's throwing a flag and saying, I got bullied by Kelsey, Hannah Ann's throwing the flag a day later, you know, really slow on the, you know, slow on throwing the flag. Is Peter able to go back to the film and see that, did Kelsey say exactly what Hannah Ann said she did?
I totally agree. But this is the other kind of thing that it dovetails into for me, because this is only my second season. So I'm learning a little bit of the movements of the show and how everything kind of works. But I find that getting caught up in these little disputes is often a losing play, because
definitely,
and especially very early on, there develops like a very odd segment of the house of people who are just there to essentially like direct the to be like, oh my god, did you see this? And or the people who just tell on the other people, and they're never making the move, they're never like kind of breaking into the actual love portion of it, they're just there for the drama a little bit, you
know? Yeah, I did think Hannah Ann kind of handled this one pretty well, like in terms of how she presented it to Peter and then kind of staying quiet afterward when Kelsey came back to the group and was upset about it. But
do you tell on the person? Would you tell?
Well, I would like to say that I would be a person who wouldn't tell, but I think that I would probably just blurt it out, because that's how I am. I would have this grand plan of being like, yeah, I'm above it, I don't deal with the pettiness, but then I'd be in front of the person and I'd be like, guess what she did? Like, that's who I am, Connor. I have to own it. I'm embarrassed to say, but
I think if you're Peter, I thought that was a good moment where, I mean, maybe, I don't know, I could be regretting this like as I get further down the road on this point, because I'm not sure, but he did then come back oddly strong and say there's not going to be any bullying in this house, nobody's going to bully anybody, but by doing that you're clearly taking the word of the person that you like more than the other one.
Totally.
Right off the bat, you know.
Totally.
So while it is a positive anti-bullying stance, which we can all get behind, nobody should bully anybody, you're right, you need to have some sort of definitive proof other than the one that I think is better looking is telling me that, you know, you're being mean to everybody and so you got to shut it down.
This is sounding a lot like pass interference, Connor, you know, not
wow.
to always bring it back to the football, but I mean, we all can agree that interference is not a good thing, but what do the referees, what are their reasons for calling it or not? And is there, you know, as we referenced earlier, you know, is there some shadow conspiracy, you know?
I mean, there always is.
There
the
always
answer is yes.
On this show, there always is.
My final takeaway there is that I'm pretty bummed that, you know, I felt very led down the road with Hannah B coming back.
Yeah.
I mean, a Hannah B versus Hannah A for Peter's love would have been seismic. I mean, this would have been, you know,
Mahomes Rogers.
Oh my god. I mean, it would have been amazing, you know, these two Hannahs who know how to play this guy and they're just ripping his heart into pieces on television. I mean, man, that would have been the move, you know. But then you immediately discount the other 20 whatever people in the house too.
Yeah, I mean, it's also crazy that we have two main characters in back-to-back seasons named Hannah.
Mm-hmm. And then I would guess the only other thing there is just a tough night for my dark horse, Tammy, the house flipper from Syracuse. She seems to be moving into more of like an analyst role on the show right now, you know? I don't know. I just was... I just thought she would have been a good match for Peter, you know, very strong, self-sufficient, funny, but it just doesn't seem to be popping in that direction, you know?
Yeah, she kind of got she was like a reference for Kelsey at one point with the fight. And our producer Shelby points out that there were two Hannahs in the final four last year, and now we have another prominent Hannah. So this is like becoming like Sean McVay disciples. They're just popping up everywhere. So we've really gotta keep an eye on this trend in Bachelor Nation. On that note, we will sign off for the week and see you after the championship games. The MMQB Weekside Podcast is me, Jenny Rentis, and Connor Orr. We are produced by Shelby Royston. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody. Ben Eagle is director of editorial projects and product. Mark Moravec is emeritus executive director of the MMQB. Keep up with our entire lineup of podcasts 5 days a week by subscribing to the MMQB NFL Podcast for free on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, please do us a favor and leave us a rating and review. It really does help other people find the show, which is available on Spotify, Radio.com, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.